I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Hey, why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly biotechnology podcast that's not just about biotechnology. Providing information to help you change hearts and minds. Moving innovations to application with communication.
Welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast, the weekly podcast where we discuss contemporary issues in science and technology with a focus on biotechnology and new innovations that can help people and the planet. I'm Paul Vincelli, sitting in for Dr. Kevin Volta. Kevin, thanks again for the chance to participate in the Talking Biotech Podcast. And today we're going to be talking about aflatoxin. And we're going to be speaking to one of the very well-known experts in this area, in our own society of the American Phytopathology Society, and that is Dr. Peter Ogiambo from North Carolina State University. Welcome, Peter, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Paul.
So you just had, I guess, several weeks ago or maybe a month or two ago, a paper accepted in the journal Phytopathology, the title of which is Cultural and Genetic Approaches to Manage Aflatoxin Contamination. Recent insights provide opportunities for improved control. This is quite a massive paper, quite substantial, and so congratulations.
Thank you, Paul. Yes.
So we'll certainly, you know, center on that topic. But aflatoxin is well. First of all, let me say a little bit more about you. You are an associate professor in the Department of Plant Pathology at North Carolina State University.
Yep. Yes.
And you are from your bachelor's and your master's degree, the master's being in plant pathology. That was from the University of Nairobi in Kenya.
That's correct. Yes, yeah, that's correct.
With a PhD at the University of Georgia.
Yep.
And so, you know, I always like to start our podcast by having guests say something about themselves, and certainly your history, you know, is intriguing. Having been born and raised in Kenya, and now working here at NC State on a problem that occurs, I'm sure, in Kenya.
Right.
Tell us about your background. How did you arrive to the point where you're at in your career?
Well, just like you've said, originally I'm from Kenya. I was born in Kenya several years ago, of course, and then I went for my Bachelor of Science in Agriculture at the University of Nairobi, you know, around in 1990, and then from there I went on to do a master's in plant pathology in 1995, then I graduated in 1996. I finished, and then from there actually I was able to join the International Potato Center, the Sub-Saharan African Region Office, which is actually based in Nairobi, and I worked there as an assistant potato pathologist for 4 years, and then after that, then I came to the University of Georgia to do my doctorate with Harold Sham in the Department of Plant Pathology. And then during that particular time, before I came to the United States in 2001 of the fall, while working at SIP, I had, you know, opportunities to travel in Africa, you know, to engage with the collaborators that work on potato light blight, which was my primary focus, looking at these new lineages of potato light, the pathogen itself, and then primarily focusing on, you know, looking at options for disease management through breeding, you know, because, you know, there's a lot of use of fungicides, and you know, most of this, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, they're very expensive, and growers, you know, most of the growers that we're dealing with are small-scale growers, and having disposable income to purchase fungicide was like it's not a given. And so the International Potato Center thought, you know, breeding, just like we, even here in the United States, for example, having a genotype that, you know, growers can utilize very well without necessarily having to worry about fungicide input, I think is one way to provide sustainability in terms of production. So briefly, that's what I did. And then I came to Georgia in 2001, worked on blueberries, you know, and I graduated in 2004, then did a postdoc for 1 year at the University of Georgia. And then I went back to Africa to work for the International Institute of Tropical Agriculture as a postdoctoral fellow, you know, in 2005. Yeah, that's where 2005. I started 2006, and then 2007. That's when I finished, and then came back to NC State here in 2008. So briefly, that's what it is. What I did.
Yeah, wow.
I'm impressed.
Yeah, I'm actually also looking at your. We'll have a link to your website
and right.
on our homepage. But I'm looking at your publications, and it is really. Quite an extensive list. You've been very productive in, but also very. You've engaged in diverse experiences. You've engaged. You studied diverse pathosystems with diverse authors. So, you know, it's really interesting because you and I know each other as counselors at large for the American Phytopathology Society. So we get to know each other that way.
Right.
And now I've had a chance to look at your. CV for the first time, and it's really quite astounding. So
thank you. I mean I've had an opportunity, you know, like my training is primarily an epidemiologist, but I also do population biology, where I try to link population genetics and epidemiology in what we call the paradigm of population biology, where you try to utilize the two disciplines to provide sort of a comprehensive assessment of what disease management is all about. And over the years, I've had a chance to work with very excellent population biologists, population genetics, for example, here at NC State, you know, that I've worked with. And a lot of that has been very productive, you know, in so many ways, because you tend to augment your disciplines to provide a very good product, you know, and this can be within the United States or across the board. And a lot of that is actually reflected on some of the papers that have been published. We have several authors, you know, because bringing people from different disciplines together, try to think about what we're trying to do, but provide elements of mathematics, statistics, genetics, you know, genomics, and that kind of stuff to really mold this into something that is actually much more meaningful by drawing, you know, from different disciplines. Because we know very well, you know, disease management, you know, is actually a concerted effort. So just somebody with epidemiology alone is not going to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. And if you have genomics alone, it's not going to solve the problem. But if you bring the two together and from different disciplines, you are able to see the problem with a new perspective. And that's some of the things that I've been trying to do over the years. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, wonderful. Well, it's really, again, a pleasure to have gotten to know you in the context of the society we both provide a service for, but now to work with you on this. So your review paper in phytopathology is in the preprint stage. It's been accepted and really rather comprehensive. So why don't we start by, you know, something that I know that you know very well, but many of our listeners may know, but some may not. So what is aflatoxin and why are we concerned about it?
Well, before I answer that particular question, I want to just take this opportunity to thank my co-authors.
Sure.
You know, we have Paola Bartolani, you know, from Italy, and then we have Jeff Carey with the USDA ARS in Mississippi, and then we have New Orleans, sorry, and then we have Bart Bloom at the University of Arkansas, and then of course Ignacio Carbon, who is here at NC State. So this was a concerted effort, you know, just to bring an what we know from different disciplines, from different authors, different backgrounds, to try to make this review, this paper, a little bit much more comprehensive in that end.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
So, aflatoxin, as most of you know, we have fungi, there are fungi that are able to produce, toxins, for example. These are called mycotoxins generally. And they infect the plant, and then during that infection process, they're able to produce secondary metabolites. And aflatoxin is one of those secondary metabolites that are produced by members of Aspergillus section flavae. They include Aspergillus flavus, Parasiticus, Nomias, there's so many within that particular section.
Several species of
Aspergillus, yeah. So these are secondary metabolites, that are produced within the, they can produce in corn, for example, when corn is infected, in wheat, it can be produced in nut, tree nuts, for example, it can be produced in beans, it can be produced in coffee.
Mentioned peanuts, I'm sorry.
Yeah, in peanuts, yes. So there's a wide range of, cereals and tree nut crops, and peanuts, of course, legumes for that matter, that aflatoxin is actually present after infection by this species of Aspergillus section flavae. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good. Yeah. And so, again, this is not foreign to you and me, but I think my knowledge of aflatoxin was very limited when I was in graduate school. There's just so much to learn in graduate school. So I think it was a pretty small part of what we studied. But, as I studied corn here at the University of Kentucky and served as the corn pathologist, I, of course, made sure I knew plenty about aflatoxin because it does occur in states like Kentucky, but more so, more frequently at higher concentrations in tropical or parts of the world with high heat conditions. Can we say that? Is it more of a problem in developing countries associated with equatorial Africa, for example?
Yeah, there's a belt. There are some review papers out there that actually look at the risk of aflatoxin contamination within crops, cereals, tree nuts. And a lot of that has to do with, there's a latitude around the equator, below and above that particular equator, is a very good hotspot for toxin formation. And a lot of that is driven by the weather, temperature, humidity, rainfall, all these factors that are sort of stress the crop, that make it most susceptible to infection, and then contamination follows during that particular period of time. And the reason why we worry about it, of course, we know that it has been directly or indirectly linked to it's a food safety issue,
Tell us about that.
And that kind of stuff. So when for example, humans or animals consume produce that is contaminated with aflatoxin, they can have several healthy problems, and the well-known is it's a carcinogenic, compound, or metabolite that's able to cause cancer in humans as well as animals. It has been demonstrated actually that it can actually cause that. So there's a direct link between consumption over time and the development of certain types of cancers. But also, if you look at children, for example, children that are still young and growing, they are fed contaminated, produce through either, weaning foods and that kind of stuff. They tend to be to have stunted growth, and because of the contamination of the toxin itself within their system. So they don't grow as they should grow. So there's a stunted growth, growth and development is reduced, and if you're dealing with the immune compromised patients, for example, then it actually even gets worse because it predisposes them to infection from other very otherwise could be less serious illnesses, for example.
I think that your paper mentioned chronic exposure to aflatoxins as a risk and mentioning some of the things you just said, and also the thing that surprised me was that a statement that that about 5 billion people globally, globally were at risk of chronic exposure to aflatoxin in developing countries.
Right.
Wow. I mean, I knew it was a significant issue, especially in developing countries, but that's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot. I mean, and a lot of that, we always have we have the chronic exposure and then we have the acute exposures. The chronic exposure are very subtle. They occur little by little, contamination over time, unlike the acute ones. that will, you know, you consume tons of it a very short period of time, and then you have, you can even, somebody can actually die because of that. But those acute ones are very, they don't occur very often, you know. But the chronic exposure ones are the much more serious ones, for example, because they occur in little amounts, intakes of little amounts, but over a long period of time. And so because it's occurring at over a long period of time, people might not really notice right away what's really going on. But down the road, that's when you start having all these problems because of that. And then a lot of this has to do with either the absence, you know, of regulatory limits. If you don't have limits, you're consuming little by little over time, and it's building up within your system. Mm-hmm. And then where even some of the limits are present, particularly in developing countries, if they're not being enforced, of course, you're going to have so many problems.
Yeah.
And then if you don't have resources for testing, you might have the limits, but if you don't have resources for testing, you're still exposing the public to that, to those levels of aflatoxin over time. And because of that, this has been estimated, particularly in developing country, because of all these issues that might be in place in terms of monitoring and testing and the technology availability and that kind of stuff, up to about five billion people actually at risk of exposure. That's massive.
And so you bring up this is such a, you know, such a rich topic for exploration, and because of so many dimensions. You brought up the a couple things, the regulatory limits, which we'll circle back to, but you know, the developing countries, well, in developed countries, those of us with developed economies, we're blessed with the resources and the regulatory oversight so that aflatoxin, when it occurs in our crops, is often segregated out, identified and segregated out and cleaned out or used for cattle feed or something like that.
Right.
Whereas in developing countries, they may have the interest in monitoring and segregating, but they don't necessarily have the wherewithal, the economic wherewithal. So in developing countries, and this is an important point for listeners to understand, developing countries, the exposure, particularly to the chronic, you know, kinds of exposures that you've mentioned, is really a widespread problem.
Yeah, it's a widespread problem, and the reason why that is the case is because most of the economies in the developing countries, you know, they're subsistence economies, and what they do is that they want to create a product, you know, that they can sell. So they're actually selling. The tendency is to sell the good ones, so they sell the good clean corn, and by selling the good corn, they're actually remaining the one that is contaminated, and that's the one that they end up eating, which makes the problem even worse because of that. And you know, one of the challenges has always been, what do we do with this contaminated corn or contaminated wheat or rice, for example, or contaminated nuts or peanuts, that kind of stuff? Do we just throw it away, burn it up, or what do we do with it? Because you know, you can have like a million tons of corn, for example, or rice that has been contaminated by aflatoxin. What do you do with it?
You know,
you just throw it away, you know, because if it's above the limits, for example, you know, we have 20 parts per billion, for example, here in the United States. In the European Union, it's actually 4 parts per billion. It's even much, much more lower than that. And of course, because of that, there have been issues to do with the trade, you know, like in developing countries where exporting corn or peanuts to European Union countries, for example, because of those limits, you know, there's been concerns that, you know, it's going to sort of certainly have a negative impact in terms of trade and, you know, economies down in the developing countries that rely on some of this produce and commodities for export.
So let's I want to be sure listeners heard that. So you mentioned a 20 part per billion threshold in food and feed in the United States.
That is correct.
And a 4 parts per billion threshold in the European Union.
That is correct.
And that is parts per billion.
Parts per billion. Parts per billion.
That's very, very little.
Very small. Very small. I mean, of course, one of the, you know, these limits are put in place for safety purposes, you know, and so... And, you know, if there is more stringent, of course, I'm making sure that the population is sort of protected from potential exposure to aflatoxin. And every country is going to have their own guidelines depending on how they perceive the risk itself. Mm-hmm. But more so, it's actually what's really happening to the growers that are producing the produce. You know? And so if the product doesn't meet the market requirements, what alternatives do they have? There are some technologies that have been developed, like that, like clays, for example, using to remove the toxin, and also like ozone treatment, for example. But one thing that I wanted the listeners to know is that aflatoxin is a very stable compound, and you know, heat treatment and all these other things that can potentially be done don't really have a very big effect, you know, in terms of reducing the toxin contamination within the produce. So yeah, it's because it's very stable and heat labile, which means it can withstand and still remain stable even at higher temperatures. Mm.
You know? Yeah. So once you got it, it's pretty hard to get.
And a lot of research, you know, that has been put in place. People are still working on alternatives, you know, in terms of using ways to come up, you know, to be able to substantially reduce. If you, for example, let me give you one very, very simple analogy. Mm-hmm. If you come up with, you have like 1,000 parts per billion, okay, within the produce, and then the clay or the ozone treatment reduces it to say 500 by half.
Yeah,
that's massive, but you're way above the threshold of 20 parts per billion.
You're still stuck with corn you can't use.
Exactly. And then you want to have a situation whereby, you know, under ideal condition, you want to have no toxin at all remaining in the produce after treatment, which is very, very difficult to achieve given the current technologies that we have.
So, you know, I want to stress with listeners as well, the parts per billion issue, you know, that is so small. The way that I've learned to communicate the minute level we're talking about here, and we're talking about a natural carcinogen, folks, is one part per billion is equivalent to 1 second in 32 years.
Yeah.
And that's, and so 20 parts per billion is the legal limit for food and feed in the United States, and 4 parts per billion in the European Union. So very potent stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly. Yes. Right.
So let me ask you, Peter, you know, just a sort of a biologist question. I'm curious to know, given your knowledge, why do these fungi, these Aspergillus fungi, certain ones, why do they produce aflatoxin? What is the reason from the fungus's standpoint?
Well, we actually really don't know why, to be more precise. We really don't know why Aspergillus flavus produces aflatoxin.
Okay.
What's the role of the toxin? There have been a little bit of experiments, studies that have been conducted, you know, and it seems like what some of the theory that are out there, it has to do with the oxidative response, the response of the pathogen or to the fungus to the environment. Remember, Aspergillus flavus or Parasiticus, they are not true pathogens, because they are actually saprophytes that live in the ground, in the soil, in the plant debris. Okay. And when the plant becomes susceptible for some reason, like drought stress or lack of fertility and that kind of stuff, they are able to infect the corn.
Or the kernels.
Yeah, the kernels, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but under normal conditions, if there's no stress and everything else is being done very well, there are no avenues for the fungus they're supposed to get in. Aspergillus flavus is just a saprophyte. It's all over the place, you know. So the issue has always been what triggers, you know, the fungus from a saprophytic state to a more pathogenic state.
Yeah,
and that trigger has always been has ramification. For example, that's why there have been a little bit of, you know, sort of big challenges in breeding for corn for resistant to aflatoxin, because it's really not a true pathogen. And like, you know, we have Fusarium or we have Rhizoctonia,
whatever it is,
which makes it a little bit difficult. So going back to the question about why the fungus produces aflatoxin. So people really don't understand. They're trying just to be able to The recent, you know, literature, a lot of this has been done from the University of Georgia, where they have linked this to the ROS, the reactive oxygen species. It's something related to stress, something related to the ability of the plant to overcome some environmental stress. Mm-hmm. And that seems to trigger, you know, the formation of for the pathogen to produce a toxin to sort of somehow shield itself from the environmental under certain environmental conditions.
Okay.
But there's no direct link to really say this is really why the reason why the pathogen or the fungus produces the toxin.
Yeah.
But it has been linked to that the reactive oxygen species and stressability of the plant. When the plant infects the pathogen, when the fungus invades the host, yeah. Those triggers that are produced during that particular period of time tends to sort of lead us to believe that it's more of like a kind of a stress response to the environment and infection of the host by the fungus. But there's no clear answer as to why that is happening. You know,
I'm in a way I'm relieved to hear you say that because I've never seen an explanation, a research-based explanation for what aflatoxin actually does for the fungus.
Yeah.
I thought maybe I missed something, but
yeah, you're right because you know. One way to look at the importance, if you look at secondary metabolites, for example, if we're doing genomics or genetics, for example, we have the wild type and then we have the mutant. And so if we knock out the gene responsible for a particular expression of a particular phenotype, and then we inoculate the wild type as well as the mutant, you know, onto the host, most of the pathogens that we are true pathogens, we see there is a reduction in sporulation, or it takes the aggressiveness goes down, or for example, it takes longer for the symptoms to express. So there's always a fitness cost associated with the loss of that particular phenotype. But for flavors, you know, the wild type as well as those that produce the toxin, there's no much difference, you know, in terms of the colonizing the kernels, you know, infection. So we don't really see a true benefit of really having the toxin, because the growth, if you look at the growth morphology of the non-toxin producers, just the same as the ones that produce the toxin.
So in one group of phenotypes, you do see a loss of if you knock out the aflatoxin production, you see a loss in the ability to colonize the plant, but not in the other. Group of what I'm not using the right terminology, but am I getting the right idea?
Yeah. So the idea of what I'm trying to say is that you're pretty much close. What I was trying to say is that in traditional pathogens, where a particular phenotype is of benefit to the pathogen, when you knock out that particular phenotype, the wild type does much better, you know, compared to the to the mutant that doesn't have that particular expression or that particular phenotype, because that phenotype that the fungus is producing or the pathogen is producing confers some advantage to the one that has it compared to the one that doesn't have it. But for aflatoxin and A flavors, the wild type as well, the one that don't produce the toxin as well as the one that produce the toxin, they're just very similar. So there's no advantage that you can say that, okay, those that produce the toxin are more aggressive or they are more rapid colonizers or they grow very fast. No. So there's no differences between the two, which tells us we really don't understand why it does. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good.
But for the reverse, you know, in the traditional sense, if you take a normal pathogen that has a particular phenotype for resistance, for example, A, B, and C, when you knock out that particular gene, they tend to be less competitive, you know, or they are poor colonizers or they become less aggressive, something like that. But we don't see that, you know, within A flavors and aflatoxin formation. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, this is... it's a fascinating subject and one that has great importance to human health. So let's take a short break. And we're talking to Dr. Peter Ogiambo from North Carolina State University. We're talking about aflatoxin. And when we come back, we're going to sort of delve into the management questions. What do we do about this issue? So stay tuned. And thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast.
Today's episode on the Talking Biotech Podcast is just another reminder that aflatoxin is a critical problem in world food security. It emphasizes the need for solutions, and the discussion today is really important because it talks about how this is really a marriage of cultural change, using alternatives, and also considering biotechnology solutions. Now, this is really important because so many people are affected. We've heard many different estimates, and I don't know that anyone knows for sure, but it's a potent carcinogen that literally affects billions of people. It is important for us to understand as communicators because aflatoxin mitigation by biotechnology is a great example of how this technology can be used for something that we all agree upon. We frequently encounter the argument that these technologies are only useful for large corporations to make money and poison the environment. But here's a perfect application of how these technologies can be used to be able to generate new products that can help people mitigate a significant health threat. So I urge you to learn more about this topic. Revisit episode 74 with Dr. Monica Schmidt, episode 104 with Brett Ryerson. It talks about some ways that we can solve problems with aflatoxin by proper drying of crops and post-harvest solutions for storage. Episode 114, we talk to Dr. Dilip Shah, who talks about ways that they've been able to control aflatoxin on peanut. Altogether, these episodes represent ways that we can better communicate topics that people really do care about. And perhaps it's the way to move the needle and start to drive acceptance of technologies that are generally very positive. So thank you again for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. And I hope you use this episode and the topic of aflatoxin as a whole as a cornerstone in your discussions about why this technology may be useful to people all around the world.
And we're back on the Talking Biotech podcast with Dr. Peter Ogiambo from North Carolina State University. And welcome back, Peter. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Paul.
So we've framed at least some aspects of this very important problem, aflatoxin, in various crops, but certainly in corn, a lot of attention has been, research attention has been in corn. Mm-hmm. We can't exhaustively cover the management topic, but let's give it a whirl. Yeah. We'll see how far we can get.
That's right.
What do you think our listeners should know, at least to begin this discussion on management? What do you want to emphasize?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that I wanted to emphasize is that, you know, as I said before, you know, the host susceptibility, for example, the environment becomes a very an important component of aflatoxin formation, the infection process and that kind of stuff. As I said, if Aspergillus flavus, one of these second flavi, they are predominantly saprophytic, and then, of course, they're able to transition being pathogenic or be able to infect the plant.
So let me just interrupt for a second here, Peter.
Yep.
So for those who are not familiar with that term, mm-hmm. saprophytic, Peter's referring to the fact that these are molds that are largely growing on dead organic matter on the soil surface, maybe a little bit buried in the soil, but dead organic matter. And so the shift to a pathogenic state is when the very same fungus, instead of growing saprophytically on dead organic matter, has now somehow allowed itself to, well, through the stress on the plant, to colonize certain selected parts of the plant, and particularly the kernels.
That's indeed correct. And thanks for clarifying that, Paul. So we have the saprophytic stage and then the pathogenic phase. So that shift, for example, the saprophytic to the pathogenic phase, we know when the plants become stressed, for example, moisture, you know, becomes, or when they're not, when the nutrients are low and that kind of stuff, anything that stresses the plant, be it insect damage, for example, during feeding, anything that stresses the plant is a good avenue for flavors to be able to infect the crop. And so one of the things has always been make sure you keep your plants healthy, you know, they are well taken care of, you know, well watered. Mm-hmm. There's no stress in terms of moisture, fertility, and that kind of stuff. But of course, you realize that, you know, when you're only focusing on flavors, Aspergillus flavors and aflatoxin, that's probably makes a lot of sense. But out there in the environment, you know, when you make the plant healthy, also it becomes susceptible to other pathogens. So that's something also to keep in mind. So, you know, so it's not that straightforward.
Okay.
That's one thing that also that can be done. But there are so many other approaches. Most of these are what we call the pre-harvest methods, and of course, and then we have what we call the post-harvest. Most of this done.
Let's take those in sequence. So pre-harvest.
So when you do pre-harvest, most of these are things that you do before harvest, from the time you plant, you know, to the time when you harvest a crop, and a lot of this has to do with cultural practices, like, you know, if you know about planting a variety or cultivar that is, you know, seems to be tolerant to infection, that's something you can actually do. Looking at planting density, planting time. When you do like planting time, you want to make sure that when you plant your crop and it's at the flowering stage, because this is when infection takes place. I'm saying this for corn, specifically for corn. You want to make sure that there's no stress during that particular period of time. So you have to time your planting such a way that by the time it's flowering, you know, like 50% flowering or silking, what we call it in corn, then you don't have a lot of stress during that particular period of time, because we know that's when the spores produced by Aspergillus flavus goes into the silks and is able to enter into the kernels or the ears during that particular period of time. And you also don't want to have insects damage during that particular time, because insects will cause, you know, injury to the crop, to the ears, and there will be avenues through which the spores will get in. And so trying to minimize that during that particular time will actually be a very, very important thing. And then one of the other things that we need to that's probably what that has been utilized right now is actually biological control, you know.
That's an area that I knew of, but your paper was very enlightening. So tell us about the biocontrol.
So the biocontrol, you know, there, you know, just a little bit of background without going into so many details, you know Aspergillus flavus has strains that are able to produce the toxin and strains that are not able to produce the toxin. So the goal in biocontrol is to, particularly right now, based on the technology that we know, this was developed in the early 80s, you know, has to do, Peter Corti at Arizona has done most of this, you know, and when we have Aflagard, that which was based on a strain that was actually from a peanut field in Georgia. So we have two commercial products, Aflagard and AF36, that are currently available for people to use. And they essentially... Yeah, these are commercial products. Essentially, the biocontrol is based on the premix that you apply tons of the non-toxin producing strain ahead of time to outcompete, you know, the toxigenic strain that comes in later on. So this is done earlier on around silking to sort of cover the what we call the infection course in plant pathology, and sort of it will be able to outcompete the toxigenic strain that are primarily in the soil when they come in. So you already have something already present there before the toxigenic strain comes in. And that's how it works, essentially.
So you're applying the non-toxigenic strains.
That's correct.
To the silks, like as a spray?
Yeah, can be done in different ways. You can use a plane to apply it, you know, around silking. You know, the timing is very critical, because the window during which this occurs is very small. So if you miss that window, then of course you're going to be out of luck. Mm-hmm. In Africa, you can just broadcast it. You know, growers can broadcast, you know, the commercial product, you know,
on the ground,
and it will be able to move from the ground onto the silks.
Yeah. Okay, by sporulation and and air movement to
that's
the
correct
from the ground to the silks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's how it works. So right now, biocontrol, given the difficulties for breeding for resistance, for example, the traditional approach, you know, and the things that I talked about, the fact that, you know, phenotyping for aflatoxin, you know, infection is not that straightforward. You know, biocontrol, as for now, is one of the key options for reducing aflatoxin contamination in so many products. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to quote your paper again in just a moment. So the idea here is basically you're applying this non-toxigenic strains, these non-toxigenic strains, so they're in all respects, they look like Aspergillus flavus and act like Aspergillus flavus, but they happen to not produce the aflatoxin toxin.
That's correct.
And if you get those out in advance of the activity of Aspergillus flavus, you can protect by competitive displacement, basically.
Yeah, that's right.
Protect the silks and therefore protect the kernels from attack. And I think what really was impressive, I knew about this atoxigenic biocontrol approach for years, but I guess I didn't realize how effective it was. Your paper cites, I'll just read the sentence, consistent reductions in aflatoxin contamination ranging from 67 to 99%.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's very impressive.
Very impressive.
And this is done, but in Africa, in the United States, and also in Europe. So there's a collection of studies where they have actually shown how effective it can be, when done right and under the right conditions, that kind of stuff. It can be very, very effective.
Yeah. So that is certainly impressive. What about conventional breeding? You did discuss that in the paper, it's certainly. Yeah, tell us about conventional breeding. Has that worked?
Yeah, conventional breeding has not worked. I mean, and a lot of that, as I said before, has to do with how pathogen works. When you're breeding for resistance, you have to be able to have a very good way of actually phenotyping. What you are really looking at, for example. Quick methods of assessing, really, because remember here we are breeding against after contamination. So you have to wait for the cone to and see how much levels are there and that kind of stuff. It's very different from like a foliar pathogen, potato late blight, for example, where you actually look at the leaf area infected, for example. You can phenotype that quickly and that kind of stuff. And so that has been a challenge, and then if you look at also, most of the materials that could potentially have resistance to aflatoxin contamination, they're in backgrounds that are not readily cannot be readily be put into commercial lines, for example. And that has also been one of the challenges, to do that. How to move them consistently to be able to maintain, those levels of expression has always been a challenge. And the reason why that is a challenge is because they are linked to some undesirable agronomic traits. Yeah. Because you can have a very super resistant, cultivar,
right,
but the ears, are not very nice to look at, or it takes long to mature, or it has a very different color, and that kind of stuff. Or nobody's going to buy it, and that kind of stuff. And so those are some of the challenges using traditional approaches.
Yeah.
Why conventional approaches have not been very, very effective.
So that's a very good point, and you've discussed it fully in the review paper, and you used in the review paper the phrase linkage drag, which is a common scientific phrase to describe when you've got gene X that you're very interested in, and you make the cross so that gene X comes into your germplasm that you're trying to breed, but along with gene X come hundreds of other genes that you don't want. May be undesirable, and so it becomes very challenging to really make progress with conventional breeding. So I know that I want to switch into discussing the genetic engineering approach, because you did cover that, but I one question that is very timely in this discussion is, right, let's say you've got gene X in conventional breeding and you can't move it effectively because of linkage drag linkages to undesirable genes. Why would it be feasible to take a gene from the variety that is the source of gene X and move it by genetic engineering instead of by conventional breeding, and that way you sort of escape the linkage drag problem?
Yeah, and I think that's something that within the paper, in fact, we actually spend so much time talking about those alternative approaches to conventional breeding. Most of these are transgenic approaches to achieve aflatoxin. A lot has been done, and these new approaches are primarily designed, to be able to cut on time that is needed to sort of move genes of desirable agronomic, traits or qualities into a background that, growers are likely to use, and it's likely to be commercialized and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then there have been so many approaches, there are people have not been able to, we have been able to sort of look at, incorporating, genes, people have done a lot of this work, incorporating genes for resistance in the host using transgenic approaches. A lot of this is actually much more recent. A very good example is, we have the CRI, what we call the CRISTAL gene, that encodes some proteins like in BT, for example. Mm-hmm. This is one that has been done, was done a little bit earlier on, where that particular gene can be expressed, and when, for example, the insects come in to feed on it, they're actually not able to do that because it protects from feeding from insects. Because I said before, insect feeding provides avenues through which the spores get in and cause contamination and that kind of stuff, particularly if you're dealing with these oxygenic strains. And so this is just an example of how this, transgenic approaches actually has helped. And, if you look at, one of the challenges has always been, why do we have to worry so much about transgenic approaches? One of the things has always been the fact that, as we know right now, breeding for corn that is resistant to aflatoxin contamination using conventional approaches has been going on for a long, long time. And there's nothing that is out there that people can actually say, okay, this is a commercial product, has been bred through conventional approaches, and people can actually buy it. There's nothing out there at the moment, and because of that, one of the challenges, like I explained before, also before I explain the next thing, is because the fungus does not, it's not a kind of like if you have the host and the pathogen, we have what we call the gene for gene hypothesis if you're doing a host pathogen interaction. If you have a particular gene in the host, there's a corresponding gene in the pathogen that when the host is able to recognize that particular pathogen, it will sort of mount some defense response. That's what we call the gene for gene response, hypothesis, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the flavors and the corn, for example, interaction, they don't follow those rules. And because they don't follow those rules, it's actually very hard to breed for resistance using the traditional approaches. And that's one of the reasons why.
Using traditional approaches.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And that's why, molecular breeding approaches using transgenics is being sort of, bring into place to be able to overcome some of these challenges.
Yeah. So I think what you're saying is, and I totally agree with this, aflatoxin may be, because of the inability to really make very much progress through conventional breeding, it really presents what would maybe be a good opportunity for a genetic engineering approach.
Right.
Not because it's always better than conventional breeding, but in this case, conventional breeding hasn't been very successful, and really what we care about is, success in minimizing or even eliminating the aflatoxin contamination.
Yeah. I mean, there have been, like, for example, one of the things that have come up recently, of course, the recent technology like CRISPR, the Higgs host gene induced silencing, for example, the CRISPR, technology, that people are actually exploring to sort of address some of these challenges. It has been demonstrated, that it can actually work, in corn, for example. And that has been a tremendous, improvement from where we were like 5 years ago and that kind of stuff in terms of just breeding for resistance, and some of, one quick study that comes into my mind is the one that was, at Arizona State, where they looked at, looking at RNAi, for example, and host gene-induced gene silencing to be able to come up with, genotypes of corn that can actually reduce contamination, and they were able to successfully do that, and for the first time they were able to show that technologies like CRISPR host gene induced silencing can actually be utilized to to substantially reduce contamination, you know, and that was a very massive improvement in terms of just the technology itself and showing that it actually can be very effective. So this was done at Arizona State, you know, Monica and her group there, you know, were able to demonstrate that. And that was very massive, and you know, in terms of just giving people the idea, okay, we can try this, you know, and we can actually show that actually it works very well. And that was to the corn industry, that was to the and research community, that was a very, very impressive work. Yeah.
For listeners, what the paper from Arizona that Peter has mentioned was really fascinating. They took just portions of a particular gene from the fungus that are critical in the production of aflatoxin by the fungus. They put those portions of genes, so they're not functional genes, they're just portions of genes, into the corn. And then the corn used those portions of genes to silence the fungus's aflatoxin producing machinery. And it was really quite a interesting study. I understand that there's a kind of a next step that's needed to see. What they did was they showed elimination of aflatoxin in their greenhouse study or growth chamber study. But now the next question is, will it hold up in the field? I guess
I mean, I think as we know, I mean, this was, you know, most of, if you look at aflatoxin, you know, this technology, like the RNAi technology, for example, you know, the kernels need to be metabolically active to be able to express, you know, that particular gene, to express that particular phenotype of importance. But so the next step that they're trying to look at, okay, what about if you have kind of like corn that is not metabolically active, like corn that is actually mature corn.
Like, so the kernels have dried down.
They're dried down. And most of the problems that we have in aflatoxin occur moving forward when the corn is dry, when it's out there in the, it's being shipped from silos to marketing and for processing and that kind of stuff. I think the next step they're probably working on right now is to actually look at, try to see how can they address the next step to make this actually effective. Because if you look at in storage, you have the fungus is there in storage. The toxin is still there too, right?
Yeah, the fungus is there as spores.
And so when the condition are conducive, for example, if you don't dry down the corn below, say, a 13% moisture content, the fungus is going to continue growing, you know, and producing the toxin and that kind of stuff. Even when you're under storage.
Okay. So not just in the field, but we want to see how these technologies
translate post-harvest, so to speak.
In the harvest. Yeah, post-harvest. Yeah, good point. Yeah, in fact, I give you a lot of credit. You and I were walking to a restaurant after a long day serving as counselors. And we had a nice conversation about aflatoxin. So that's when I realized, geez, I got to get this guy on Talking Biotech Podcast.
But that said, I just wanted to point out something really quick. You know, that's very, very important. That you know, these technologies are making life. They're out there to be utilized for us to be able to, for research scientists to use them to make a difference in terms of, you know, not necessarily aflatoxin, but on other pathogens there, where the technology can actually be utilized to reduce, you know, their levels in the field and that kind of stuff. But what's more important, you know, that needs to be really addressed is, you know, ultimately, you know, when this technology is actually out there successfully, you know, and you know, we have genotypes that have been developed using transgenic approaches, you know, this can only be successful if there's a willingness on the industry to be able to market these particular products. If the industry is not willing to market this particular product, then it's going to be very difficult for them to reach into the hands of consumers. But on the other hand, too, you know, is the consumer ready sort of to utilize, you know, products that have been developed using these particular approaches? Mm-hmm. That's something else, too, that needs to be addressed. Ultimately, until the industry and the consumers are willing to accept food and feed derived from genetic engineering, it's going to be very hard for us for technology just to move us to the next level where we can actually utilize it in a way that we are seeing significant impact because there's uptake by the consumers and the growers, you know, that they are willing to embrace the technology and this is what it can do for them.
Yeah.
But until that happens, that's going to be very difficult to move forward in utilizing these technologies in disease management. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And so one of the things that I guess occurs to me about this whole thing is, you know, this whole question you raise about, you know, consumer acceptance and willingness and so on is our job. You know, I'm going to sound like I'm pontificating here, but I think our job as public scientists is to make sure that people have the exposure to the this, what we know and what we don't know. Mm-hmm. So that people can make their own choice, and so, you know, there one option, one choice people may make is, oh, we're concerned about this, you know, this food, genetically engineered food, and we don't want it, and that's a legitimate choice if it's based on, you know, the facts as we understand them.
Right.
But the other possibility I think is equally as likely, and that is, you know, we're not talking about herbicide tolerant plants are engineered for herbicide tolerance. We're talking about plants engineered to reduce or eliminate a natural, very potent carcinogen. And so, you know, it seems just as likely to me that people may listen to the science, weigh it and discuss it and say, you know what, I really am concerned about the exposure to these carcinogens in my food. And you know, I'm good with going forward in that way. And that to me is true food sovereignty, where they have the choice that may or may differ from what we might choose as scientists, but they make the choice based on, you know, well understood facts.
Right. And I think you make a very good point, you know, because the, I mean, for us as public servants, we are actually supposed to give people options in terms of the, you know, our disease management. You know, we are looking at avenues in which we can better solve the problem that we have been tasked to do, and give people information related to those technologies and what they are all about, and so that people can make informed choices. You know, moving forward in terms of what they really want to do with some of these technologies,
mm-hmm. and so choices. Yeah.
That's right, exactly. You know, and so because you know we are tasked to address, as plant pathologists, our goal is to, we are talking about food security, for example, and food security, you know, you can address that using host resistance. You can do that using pesticides. You can use that using agronomic approaches. But if you look at pesticides, they have their own challenges too. You know, like in Africa, for example, use of pesticides, you know, is for low-income farmers just like out of question because they don't have money to do that. And biotechnology seems to be like, for them, you know, host resistant biotechnology seems to be one way for them to really have a very good grasp on disease management, because we're talking about something that they can have, like a seed, or they can plant the seed and that kind of stuff, without necessarily applying pesticides to it, and that kind of, because it makes life easy for them. Because we have to make these technologies, even if it's conventional breeding or transgenic approaches, or even using pesticides, it has to be sustainable in the environment.
Yeah,
you can come up with a very good hybrid or a good way of controlling disease, but if the approach is not sustainable and cannot be adopted by the growers, then it's not going to be effective. I mean, we are not going to see the impact of that particular technology or method of disease control. Yeah.
Very good. Well, I'm glad you brought up the whole subject of the social dimensions. That's important for us social scientists to understand the social dimensions and work with social scientists.
Right.
So, Peter, is there anything else you'd like listeners to know about this vast topic of aflatoxin?
Well, I mean, I think every day we are learning, you know, about the fungus and then the pathogen, the fungus itself and the host, and so we know very well, you know, the fact that it's a public health, you know, issue, aflatoxin, you know. I mean, we have these tremendous groups out there that are actually working, you know, day and night, trying to come up with ways to better handle the problem, you know. And so, and right now, you know, looks at, you know, technology is probably what we have right now. The current technology is probably the way to go, you know, to be able to facilitate the whole process, you know, to cut down on time of breeding, looking at alternatives, understanding the fungus, what's the fungus doing with this host, and utilizing technologies that can help us provide those insights, you know, is becoming much, much more important for us to harness what we know right now and sort of utilize that information to be able to come up with options that are going to be sustainable, you know, you know, people can have, you can have access, you know, you can actually also economically it makes sense, because if you look at biocontrol, for example, you know, there have been concerns that, you know, you're applying every year, you know, there are labs out there looking at, okay, can this be applied after 1 year or after 2 years and have some residual effect? So how frequent can this be applied? You know, can we come up with a new strain, for example, that are more sustainable depending on where you are, you know, and compete better, you know, and so they, and then this whole big, environment or the new theme about the impact of climate or what we call the extreme weather events or climate change, so to speak. What will climate change impact? You know, how will that impact the current technology that we have, particularly for biocontrol in terms of control, and how will that affect the fungus itself in terms of toxin production? And so people are actually looking at providing those kind of answers to, because we need to look ahead for sure, you know, and prepare ourselves as we move along. So
absolutely. Climate change is going to certainly provide progressively even more favorable conditions for the aflatoxin producing fungi, so you're absolutely right. That's a concern. So Peter, once again, thank you for joining us and sharing your knowledge, and it's been a pleasure to have you on the program, and also to get to know you as a counselor at large for the American Phytopathology Society.
Thank you so much, Paul. It was actually my pleasure to participate this morning.
Wonderful. And thank you, listeners, for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Talking Biotech. Write a review on iTunes and tell a friend to listen, as your support allows us to deliver more about exciting science to more people. I'm Paul Vicelli. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. Send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review of this podcast on iTunes and recommend it to a friend. More downloads help us reach a wider audience with science.